This is the Chris Smith Show on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Yeah, so much happening in terms of news today. That front page story by the New York Times on what Hamas has been doing over the last 4 years with the Palestinian people just shows you how they have been at the end of the barrel of a gun for quite some time. That's just 4 years of information. It's making front page news right across the world. On top of that, we've got David McBride, for those of you who just joined us. 5 years and 8 months, an incredible sentence. And I want to get to some of our open line callers if I can. Glenn, go right ahead. You want to talk about something else, do you?
No. I wanted to talk about this on us, Chris. I just wanted to explain to you the emotions I'm going through at the moment, if I can. When I was a kid learning about the Holocaust and the Second World War, I would often say to my parents, I don't understand how they got the entire population of Germany to go along with it. Now I feel like I've been put in a time warp, Chris, and sent back to Germany in the 1930s. I'm now living in a country where I have a government that hates the Jews. I have a media that hates the Jews. I have an education system that hates the Jews. And I have a vast number of my own fellow countrymen that hate the Jews. I have a moral problem that do I bend the knee and go along with the rest of my countrymen, my government, my education system and my media, and turn the blind eye to the Holocaust coming? Or do I make a stand? Well, today I make a stand. I denounce my government.
What does that mean, though, making a stand?
Well, if I see somebody in a from the river to the sea T-shirt, they get a smack in the mouth. That's probably the wrong thing to say.
That's not too smart, because you're going to end up behind bars.
So what? So what? Can you imagine in the 1930s, Chris, if the German people had stood up and started smacking a few Nazis around? Could you imagine how history would be different? And then I just hear on the news that the death rate in Gaza now has been halved, because what we've been promoting through our media is wrong. Now, I spoke to John Laws today on the radio, and he blatantly lied and said the IDF has no concern for Palestinian lives. Can you name me any other army in the history of the world that floods a place with leaflets out of aeroplanes weeks in advance to tell people to move? Can you name me any other army in the history of the world that's ever done that?
The Americans did it in Afghanistan.
Okay, well, there's one. But the blatant lie, see, the media is feeding the Jew hatred in this country. Every time we say that there's 34,000 people killed in Gaza, because those figures come from a terrorist organisation, and it was just on the news just then that the UN has revised the numbers and halved them. So for all this time, we have been feeding people in my country that want to kill me, that want to kill you, and want to kill everybody else that is not a Muslim. We have been feeding them with the food to enrage their hatred, which is terrorist propaganda.
Yeah, you are exactly right there. Let's not leave that point, because I've said all along, whenever I've heard a figure from the Palestinian organisation, authority, I should say, about lives lost, I've always said, well, hang on, you better take that back almost by half, because it is a war. We have propaganda from both sides, not just one side, both sides. If you think it only comes from one side, you're deluded. And I've always said that it's probably closer to just over half as opposed to the number that we're getting. But most mainstream media organisations use the number as a fact.
Yes, you would be about the only person in the media in Australia that actually clarifies the numbers with that statement. I've asked them on 2SM to do that. They refuse. I asked John Laws to apologise for the lie the blatant lie he told about the ADF. He refuses. Then they whinge about the anti-Semitism in our country. They are the Jew haters that are feeding the lies into the people that our government has brought into this country who want to kill us. Now, I'm asking any other Australian or anybody else in the world that is in a country in the same predicament, I'm asking you directly, will you bend the knee and allow the Holocaust, or will you stand up and do what is necessary to stop this Jew hatred? That's all I've got to say today, mate.
Good on you, Glenn. Thank you very much for calling. Someone on our chat box says that's a planted caller. Huh? How do you even do that? That's funny. That's a very funny statement. Thank you very much for that. I don't even know how you do that, but that's apparently what we've done. I will remind that particular viewer or listener about that when someone else calls and gives a completely different view. This is Chris Smith on TNT.
Your voice heard here.
The government needs to step up and do its job.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, author and ex-BlackRock portfolio manager Ed Dowd and his team estimate there have been 1.1 million excess deaths in the United States since 2021. 1.1 million. And that 33 million Americans have been injured, disabled, or killed by COVID-19 injections. While the AstraZeneca viral vector jab has been officially withdrawn from the market, the mRNA jabs are still being pushed despite known harms, and harms that have been observed that are greater than what were expected. My next guest, an expert in toxicity, will help us understand the mechanisms of toxicity in the mRNA jabs. Dr. Stephanie Zenef is a senior research scientist at MIT's Computer Science and Artificial Intelligence Laboratory in Cambridge, Massachusetts, USA. She has a BS degree from MIT in biology and MSEE and PhD degrees from MIT in electrical engineering and computer science. Her recent interests have focused on the role of toxic chemicals and micronutrient deficiencies in health and disease, with a special emphasis on the pervasive herbicide glyphosate and the mineral sulfur. She joins me live from Hawaii, US. Stephanie Zenef, welcome to TNT.
Oh, great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for your time. Is the entire LNP mRNA vaccine field a fraud?
I guess I would say so. I mean, I think they were so eager to get that technology out that they just ignored the signals that were very clear right from the get-go and just decided to push it on the entire world's population, even though I'm sure they believed that they had not done enough testing. It's very obvious to anybody that they had not done enough testing to make sure that it was safe, especially something that new. Any vaccine should have had a lot more testing, but this is not a vaccine. It's really a drug. It's a genetic, you know, injecting RNA into the human body is something that had never been done before. This kind of technology is new, and new technology requires much more vigilant studying before you release it on the public, and let alone force people to get it against their will. It is unbelievable to me that they were so aggressive about getting this everybody vaccinated with this toxic.
And the whole point of a vaccine for a flu virus, I know a professor of immunology who said to me right at the very get-go of this pandemic, the idea that you would have a vaccine appropriate in any circumstance for a flu virus is absurd, he said.
Right. Yes. I mean, this is similar to the flu in that this virus mutates very, very quickly, and we're constantly chasing it, and it's always winning. As soon as we roll out a new vaccine that's been perfected for the latest virus, the virus has moved on. Yeah. So our drugs are obsolete as soon as they're out the door.
And that was the point that he was trying to make. The mRNA jabs have been sold to us as vaccines, but you're saying that they're something different. Explain that to us.
Yeah, it's really a gene product. I mean, it's manipulating the human cell to make a foreign protein using a foreign RNA sequence that is has been humanized, so that the sequence is extremely not natural. First of all, they've taken all these uridines and replaced them with methyl pseudouridine. That is a big change. And that is what allowed them to keep the RNA alive, because normally enzymes would just remove it very quickly. And they were afraid it wouldn't live long enough to produce the spike protein that would generate the antibodies. So they were worried about it being destroyed by the immune system of the cells, by the cells getting destroyed before it had a chance to make the protein. So they engineered it to be extremely sturdy. Most mRNA usually disappears after a few hours. The cell makes it uses it to make protein, and it wipes it out after a few hours. This mRNA has been shown to be sticking around still months later after the vaccine.
Months, maybe years in some people?
We don't know how long. I mean, as long as they've looked. I mean, I think people have stopped looking at a certain point and they still see it. So we don't know how long it's going to go. It hides inside certain cell types, actually senescent immune cells, and it stays there for a long time. And that is really disturbing because it continues to make spike proteins. They've done so well at making it, first of all, not break down, and secondly, keep on making spike protein at a high rate. They've actually engineered the code. So it's not the same code that the virus uses. They did what's called code optimization, which allows it to make protein faster, which also allows it to make more mistakes. When you hurry, you make mistakes. And on top of that, those methyl pseudouridines cause it to lose track of where it is. And it'll do a frame shift, which ends up making all kinds of proteins that are completely unnatural. And who knows what they will do to the immune system. You're going to get autoimmune disease from something like that.
I want to go to a quite celebrated case, a sad but celebrated case. Maddy DeGaray was a teenager who took part in the Pfizer trial. Her mother, Stephanie DeGaray, gave the following testimony in November 2021. Have a listen.
She went to the ER 9 times and was hospitalized 3 times for a total of 63 days. Maddy experienced over 35 adverse events. In the EUA amendment, Maddie's adverse reaction was reduced to 5 lines that they claim was eventually diagnosed as functional abdominal pain. It's a stomach ache. Does your child, when they have a stomach ache, does that put your child in a wheelchair? Does your child's stomach ache require a feeding tube?
I've got a quick question. Obviously, we invited the CEO from Pfizer or some representative of Pfizer. Nobody showed up. Pfizer has to be aware of you. Have they reached out to you?
Neither Pfizer, the FDA, or the CDC has ever talked to us or attempted to. We have never heard anything from them.
At that point, Stephanie, the Pfizer jabs should have been suspended, shouldn't they?
Absolutely. And that was very early because that was when they were doing the initial trials. And instead of hiding this case, they should have been aware that this was a signal they should pay attention to.
What are the toxicity mechanisms of the mRNA products, or is it all about the spike protein?
Well, the spike protein is a lot of it, but there's more as well. They have these synthetic cationic lipids that actually can cause a lot of trouble with the blood circulation. And those cause the RNA just to not get to the place where it can be broken down by the cell. That's another trick they use to keep that RNA alive. The spike protein is exposed on the surface of the transfected muscle cells, and the immune cells come into that space. They're attracted to this muscle cells calling out for help, and they also take up the spike protein, take up the mRNA and make spike protein. That is very, very unusual because the virus doesn't infect the immune cells. They don't have that H2 receptor that allows the virus to get in, but the vaccine is looking like a lipid particle that all the cells can take it up. And the immune cells, when they take up the mRNA, they start making spike protein too. And what I'm concerned about is that some of those activated immune cells will take that spike protein, the mRNA, and make the spike protein in the thymus gland, which is going to cause immune aging. It actually causes the thymus epithelium to be damaged, and then it causes the thymus to shrink. And that is actually a very clear evidence of immune aging. So the immune system gets weak, ineffective, you get autoimmune disease, you get increased risk to cancer and to infections from all the other infective agents. It weakens the immune system. Every vaccine makes the immune system, generic immunity, weaker than it was before.
One last question before we let you go. Last month, the Arizona Republican Party passed a ban the jab resolution and declared COVID-19 injections biological and technological weapons. Would you agree? And are you encouraged by this decision?
I love this decision. I'm very excited to hear that. And I would definitely agree. I think we really have to halt this program, especially I'm concerned about injecting it into babies. In the United States, they're allowed to give it to 6-month-old children, which I think is outrageous.
And why? Why? It's just ridiculous. Why? How can people get your book, Toxic Legacy, How the Weed Killer Glyphosate is Destroying Our Health and the Environment? How can they get that book?
It's published by Chelsea Green. You can buy it from the publisher, or you can get it on Amazon. Major booksellers sell it. I have on my website, stephaniesenef.net, I have a link to various booksellers that sell my book.
Fantastic. Thank you very much for your time. It's great to speak with you.
Thank you.
No problem. Stephanie Seneff. Very, very interesting indeed. We spoke a little earlier to Mark Latham about the fact that you'd be lucky to find a whistleblower from here to Timbuktu now that this decision has been brought down today against David McBride. After the break, I'm going to catch up with a whistleblower to get his reaction to what has been brought down today in the ACT Supreme Court. Back after this on TNT.
TNT's Kate Shimarani.
And I think it's up in Bradford. It's now, the Islamic Party is now in charge. Yeah. So, you know, people are worried, oh gosh, we'll be wearing burqas soon. I'm going to say this, because I've wore a burqa when I've gone to those countries. The sun is out in the UK, and the thing about when the sun comes out is for some reason, you see all the Asian people, they're wonderful. They get all the pots and pans out. If there's a blade of grass, they're on it having a picnic with all their food. The Brits feel the need to strip off, which is okay, but I want to stab pins in my eyes with what I see going down the high street. I see massive beer guts, spindly arms, love handles that I could ride shotgun on. I see young women with it all hanging out. Put it away, girls.
Kate Shimarani on today's News Talk, TNT. A better business tip from TNT Radio. One reason people tune in to TNT Radio is often because they're loyal to a specific show or personality. Our personalities have been a part of people's daily routine, and people continue to tune in.
They trust TNT Radio
and are highly engaged with the content. If you'd like more information about advertising on TNT Radio, simply fill out your details on our contact page and we'll be in touch. To find out more, go to tntradio.live.
I want to say this, and I'm going to say it just once.
This is today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
As Mark Latham said a little earlier in one of the first political responses to David McBride's sentence, you'll be lucky to find a whistleblower willing to reveal any truths. And I wonder what current whistleblowers think of that. Jeff Morris, OAM, is a whistleblower. He joins us right now. Jeff, thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure, Chris.
What's your reaction to David McBride's sentence?
Well, I was sitting in the court only a few feet away from him, I got to say, it was an almost surreal experience. I feel that I'm living in this sort of Orwellian state. I was there last week as well. Basically, the moment the judge postponed giving the judgment until today, being budget day, it seemed pretty obvious that it was going to be a term of incarceration, as the prosecution had called for. So it wasn't entirely a surprise, but when we got to court today, the corrective services were already there waiting to take him into custody before the judge had even taken the bench. So I thought that was particularly cruel, because we then had to sit there, or David had to sit there for 2.5 hours and listen to this judgment while the corrective services were sitting up the back of the court, just itching to take him into custody. It was really, it seemed to me as if it had been almost contrived to make it as unpleasant and agonising for him as possible.
It was almost ghoulish.
Well, yeah, I mean, and at points... Well, it was also quite odd, because at points the judge accepted this the medical evidence that basically incarceration would be very bad for David, and for various reasons he accepted all that, and then we didn't hear any more about that. Then he just decided that wasn't appropriate, but it was what the prosecution wanted. It was just appalling. And and I guess perhaps the story within the story is somebody stood up immediately after the judgment in court and called out, you know what you're doing is wrong. That's why you're slipping it through today with the budget. And then there are about 30 supporters in court. The court absolutely erupted with outrage. And I think it would be fair to say people were calling out shame and various other things. And I think it would be fair to say the judge actually fled from the room. He bolted.
Is that right?
Oh, yes. And it was, but there was a huge upsurge in feeling from people who were just outraged at what they'd seen perpetrated. And nobody believed that this was right or fair or reasonable. It seemed particularly vicious. At every turn, David didn't get the benefit of the doubt. The prosecution did. Even the fact that he has two daughters, which was put forward as a reason why he shouldn't be actually incarcerated, even that was disregarded by the judge, who said, oh, well, they're at an age where, it's not such an important factor anymore. And I think they're 17 and 19. So, that didn't. And David's ex-wife, who was in court to support him, the mother of the two girls, I could see her gasp with shock and dismay when the judge, quite callously and in a callous manner, with sort of no regard for the fact that the mother of those girls was in court, just off, dismissed it as being unimportant. And she was like obviously distressed at the way that was dealt with. So, and that's pretty much the flavour of the whole judgment. David wasn't given the chance to defend himself. And I said outside the court before we went in that given the way it works, if you're charged with a national security offence, they might as well just save time and just convict you automatically, because you do not get the right to a fair trial. You have no chance to mount a defence. David had spent years and hundreds of thousands of dollars on lawyers preparing a defence. Then when he got to court, the Attorney General just appeared in court and took away all the documents that had been given to David previously, just took them away, claimed national security, and left him with no defence. I mean, I think the Salem witch trials were a model of jurisprudence compared to what's happened here in the name of national security. And I think it's just a travesty. And I just can't believe this is happening in our country in this day and age, that a man is just sent down and belittled by the prosecution and the judge, and called a thief. They're talking about theft of documents. And this is a man who acted out of the highest motivations, but he's treated as a common thief. And anyway, it seemed particularly draconian to me, the way he was treated. And again, not to give him a community correction order, it just seemed extraordinarily harsh. And it seems that there's a message being sent to whistleblowers quite deliberately. And I said outside the court, who would be a whistleblower under the Albanese government? They're making it clear they don't want whistleblowers, particularly not pointing out where, government departments have acted corruptly or wrongly. And I mean, we all know from RoboDebt that does happen. But it seems that the Albanese government doesn't want those whistleblowers coming forward with inconvenient truths. So that's the country that we're living in. It was just, I'm just in a state of shock, I've got to say. It's still hard to believe that he's been treated in this way, and that the people that he was trying to expose, the very people who had covered up war crimes, who'd facilitated them, covered them up, and then decided to cover up their cover-up by finding a few scapegoats. Those people are the ones who cite national security and take the documents that David needed to mount his defence. So
yeah, it's such a weak, devious way to negate someone's defence when you just use that hackneyed old phrase, national security. Give me a break.
Yep, yep. It's like this sort of cloak of immunity or something. They just throw it over, or invisibility cloak. They just throw it over everything, and that's bad luck. So, I mean, the Albanese government's had 2 years to discontinue this, so they can't now claim that, oh, well, it was the Morrison government. They had every opportunity to stop this, so clearly you'd have to say that they're on board with it. And as far as I'm concerned, the only solution to take our country back is to remove the Albanese government at the polls. And that's certainly what I and a lot of other people will be working towards between now and polling day.
Jeff, stay right where you are. I've got to take a 30-second break for news, and I want to come back and ask you one more question. Jeff Morris, sure. OIM whistleblower, commenting on what he saw in court today in the Supreme Court. Let's now go to the newsroom on TNT.
Now.
I've got good news and bad news.
TNT Radio News.
Matt Boyland here with a look at your TNT headlines. There's outrage in Australia, where a former military lawyer who helped expose Australian war crimes in the Middle East has been thrown in jail.
I may have broken the law, but I did not break my oath to the Australian people.
OpenAI has launched a new flagship model that can reason across audio, vision and text in real time. And the US State Department has expressed its doubts that Israel is capable of completely eradicating Hamas.
Are you enjoying listening to TNT Radio?
Do you think we're doing a good job?
Then please let us know. Why not leave us a like or a positive review or comment on Facebook, Gab, or Getter? Help us get the word out as we cover the biggest topics of our time on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back. Well, men accused of serious domestic violence offences will either be denied bail or be forced to wear an electronic monitoring bracelet under a major shakeup of New South Wales bail laws. We mentioned this with Mark Latham a little bit earlier in the program. The Premier, Chris Minns, announced the sweeping changes to DV bail policy today, all designed to make it harder for men accused of serious domestic violence offences to be released and, of course, attack again. Now, to unpack what these changes mean, we're joined now by Vicky Campion, a libertarian from far north Queensland who's been a journalist since 2002. She writes for the Daily Telegraph about politics and the realities of life for those living at the lower end of the socioeconomic scale. Vicky Campion, welcome back to TNT Radio.
Thank you for having me back, Chris.
That's okay. This is big news. The New South Wales bail laws will change. This may go to the parliament as early as this week, they're saying. There is a concern for me in all of this, and I know we need to ensure that repeat offenders don't attack again in terms of domestic violence, but I've spoken to a senior Liberal Party official about this last week. Women can still weaponise these laws to hurt innocent partners. Now, before people jump down my throat, this actually occurs, right?
Yeah, it absolutely does. I think we've got this massive issue at the moment where the current system isn't working. My problem with this so far is that we haven't seen the fine print on this bill, and we don't know how it's going to look going when it comes through the House. What is a serious offence? What do they classify as a serious offence here? Because they haven't said so far what that actually entails. I know of people who have been who have had police complaints, and they've had AVOs put in for standing over the doorway like this and refusing to let someone in the house. They received an apprehended violence order for that. I think the reality is that on one side you've got these people who are saying, "Oh, we need more electronic monitoring." Well, who's at the end of the day, if you want to do something, you will. If you want to take off your monitor, you will. What resourcing is there for when they take that monitor off? Who knows about it?
Yeah, what who polices this? That's the other point. Who polices this? Yeah.
You know, they're it's like they're putting the emphasis on the wrong end, where it should really, all of this stuff should be about prevention. And we're looking at it like, oh, well, we need to put these electronic monitoring devices on it and everything will be fine. Well, that hasn't been the case so far. The AVO orders that we had in the past, they were just ignored. The piece of paper hasn't worked so far, has it?
No, no.
At no point has it worked. Every single case, there were orders that were made and orders that were breached. I don't see a big difference from what's being proposed now, with the exception of the bracelet. Which, if you want to take it off, you'll take it off. Mm. That's what they do. Mm. But then on the other hand, it comes down to, what is a serious offence? What are they saying is a serious offence? That's
Yeah, well, the conversation I had with the senior Liberal I mentioned last week, I asked that exact question. I said, what are you talking about? Are you talking about someone physically assaulting another person? Well, they can come under indictable offences and go to the district court. That would be regarded as a serious offence. Or you can be charged with common assault and not be treated in a district court. So that's not necessarily a serious offence. So you're right. The definition of what is a serious offence is very important. But I would have also thought, looking at the way these laws are often weaponised, especially AVOs, don't we have to have a situation where the offender or the accused person has to have some kind of antecedents related to domestic violence? Because as soon as you send someone to jail, they don't get bail, or you whack out an AVO, they don't see their kids either. So they're robbed of their family, their children, because of unproven allegations. Now, I'm not suggesting for one second that we don't need to do more to protect women in particular, because the last 18 months has been atrocious. But I just worry whether this has been a knee-jerk reaction to the publicity and not well thought through.
Definitely does seem to be a knee-jerk reaction. I think, you know, when you have someone's face in a rural community and they're a single mother who has been murdered, it creates this pressure on the government to do something quickly, even if that's not necessarily the right thing to do.
Yeah.
We've had for a long time, you talk to any rural cop and they will tell you how hard their life is in terms of they go out of their way to go, oh, I wanted to tell you, I can't give details for certain cases right now, but I'm just going to try and keep it as broad as I possibly can. But someone who was injured very, very badly by their partner, the police arrested this man. He went to court. The magistrate sentenced him. It was he served not even a day before he left because he had drug issues. You know, there's this leniency on the other side of things as well.
Yeah.
The whole system just is not working. We just need to sit down and actually have a real look at what we're doing here.
Yeah, I wonder whether too much has been done to talk to stakeholders and talk about the various templates or systems that work in other jurisdictions, because I just feel as if they've jumped into this willy-nilly. Mm. And I know we accuse Chris Minns, the New South Wales Premier, of not doing enough in, you know, his new regime, but I have a feeling he may have jumped a little bit too soon on this.
I agree. I think you've got this issue, though, where AVOs are open to abuse and people do. A family that's going through that right now had their son come to dinner and he said, you can't say that to me because that will be in breach of your AVO. This is an 8-year-old child.
Yeah.
Why does he even know about this, you know? And this is how it's being weaponized within families. That's not helping the situation. And like, realistically, when you look at it and what's being accused of as violence here, it would not be violence in my book, put it that way. If someone breathed on me heavily or blocked my pathway, I would not consider that violent action.
Yeah, very true. All right, reviving the baby bonus. Bring us back to the days of Peter Costello, says John Howard. It's interesting, you know, the former Prime Minister, when he says something, people stand up and take notice. I actually think this is worth considering. Now, Jim Chalmers, the Treasurer, mentioned in a podcast last week that we need Australians to have more babies. I actually spent a lot of time on this on the program last week. Here's what he said.
You know, I don't knock what Peter Costello did all those years ago around that first intergenerational report. In fact, I've given him credit for starting the intergenerational report, which was part of this important conversation. It's helped educate our choices about the ageing of the population. It would be better if birth rates were higher. And we need to balance that against all of the other ways that our population grows. But people have got different preferences, and we want to make it easier for them to make choices in their own interests. So paid parental leave, adding superannuation guarantee to that, huge investments in early childhood education, all of these things are about trying to make it easier for people to have more kids if they want to.
Some of those figures are quite alarming. I think the birth rate's down 14% to pre-COVID levels. The fertility rate is down 20%. We could do a lot as Australians by, you know, giving birth to other Australians, because all of a sudden you're not putting pressure on the housing market, and you're also getting Australians into the workplace in, you know, 15 to 20 years' time. But you're not bringing in overseas arrivals, and you're pegging back immigration.
I think theoretically, though, it's never been easier to have a family. We've got paid parental leave, we've got maternity leave, we've got all these options. But the other thing we've got to do is we've got to stop scaring kids into the fact that they don't think there's going to be a world in 10 years.
Yeah.
That because, and this falls on curriculum and educators. And that's really where we need to be looking. We've got 17 and 18-year-old men going to the doctor and saying, I want to have a vasectomy because there isn't going to be a planet on which I can raise my child. There is no point in having a family. If you want to have Australian kids, then the first thing we've got to do is stop scaring them into the fact that we aren't into this wild fiction that climate change is going to destroy this entire country this entire world.
So true.
I think that's one of the big things. And then it also comes down to what you're willing to sacrifice, I think, as a parent.
Yeah.
Like things are different now compared to when I was a kid, and sounds very old. But realistically, when I was a kid, there was no $1,000 birthday parties.
No.
You know, you weren't, everyone wasn't flying overseas. Every single child didn't have an iPad and a gaming console. I think it really comes down to as well, you know, when they're talking about the cost of living, you have to make some own restrictions on what you're willing to give your children as a parent.
Yeah.
And then on top of that, I think we've got this other big issue, which is how you pay for a mortgage and childcare. Mm. Because this is the issue at the moment. We're basically saying there's not one woman of my generation who is a parent who doesn't work at the moment. I think they are all doing something, whether it's a side hustle, whether they're you know, around here they're running little aviaries and selling honey, or they're doing other little things.
Yeah.
In order to make a buck. Not necessarily going out and working full-time, but the ones that are working full-time to pay their mortgage are also the ones who are spending $160 per kid per day on childcare.
Yeah.
And if you get a rebate, like, good for you, but this is a real situation. This is my good friend who is a doctor in Sydney. She's trying to pay her mortgage. If she wants to pay her mortgage, she has to pay childcare, and that's $160 per kid per day, and she's got twins.
Yeah.
And so you've got this thing, this whole situation with the childcare system, where you're saying, okay, well, both one parent can't be the income provider and the other one can be the primary caregiver. Both of you have to be the income providers, and the primary caregiver is going to be this other person who we pay minimum wage while we're going to subsidize the childcare center. And then who's making the money? Yes. The center is making the money. Who's paying them? The taxpayer.
Mm.
It is
all topsy-turvy. It's all around the wrong way. And we need, once again, we need, you know, deep thought on how to encourage people to have babies and maybe
refine
some of these payments and make sure it's a little bit more. Look, I think in terms of a bad economy, when you've got a bad economy, you probably have a reluctance to have more babies. And so if you've had one, there are a lot of parents who go, holy hell, this is super expensive. I don't want to have a second. I certainly don't want to have a third or a fourth.
Yeah, I think that's true as well. But I think you've also got to admit that it comes with some sacrifice.
Yeah,
you're not doing this. You know, you're not doing, you can't go in. And there's this myth that's been fed to women where they go, oh, you can have it all. You can go and you can be super successful and you can be a great mother and you can be a volunteer and you can be a taxpayer and you can contribute to community in some voluntary capacity. Reality is you don't get to do all of those things at once.
No, you've got to do it probably staggered. You can't do it all at the same time, as I often get told. One last one. I want to go back to your main column on the weekend about power companies. You're obviously very, very fired up. You wrote, as power companies bamboozle us with taxpayer-funded greenwashing, they have left a trail of destruction in their wake. And what's worse, we, the taxpayer, funded their behaviour. Tell us about the case in point regarding Origin Energy.
So the New South Wales government sold off all of its assets, which included Eraring Coal Power Station, which is our major power provider, in 2013. That was done. We were told that it was going to settle our AAA credit rating. It was only going to be better for the people of New South Wales. Origin, the power company Origin, has bought that. Origin have now decided that they're a big green power company. And so what Origin are doing is they're buying wind factories, they're investing heavily into batteries. What we've now found out is that when Chris Bowen and Matt Keane as treasurer put in the coal price cap, the domestic price cap, that Origin kept a whole bunch of coal that it wasn't supposed to keep.
Right.
So because they've got this massive pile of coal now, the coal mine that was set up only to power Eraring, Moyuna, there's no need for Moyuna anymore, which means there's 1,000 jobs in the Hunter which are at risk. So while all of this is happening, then you've got Origin, which comes into regional New South Wales town of Walker. There's a project there which has caused no end of drama for the community. It is hundreds of wind towers, each of them bigger than Centrepoint Tower in Sydney. And this is in a town of 2,000 people. So it's a small, small town, which is going to be the next, basically we're going to be a power factory, an intermittent power factory. What's worse, or what really is the icing on the cake here, is that the local member for Northern Tablelands, Adam Marshall, has resigned from his seat, causing a by-election to go and work for Origin, the same company which is buying up all these intermittent wind factories. Now, I need to make this clear. They're buying ideas at the moment, right? Mm. All that these guys have is they've gone to a bunch of farmers and they've got wind exclusivity agreements, which they can take to the market. But there's no development application that has been approved or anything like that. It is so galling to me because Adam came to so many community meetings and stood up the front and feigned sympathy for these people. And now he's taken his 30 pieces of silver and he's gone off to work for Origin. Origin need to be answering some serious questions here. Imagine for one second, Chris. Oh, now I'm going psycho, sorry. Imagine for one second that this was a Nat MP who was in an electorate where fracking was as controversial as this is, and coal seam gas exploration. And then he has gone off to go and work for a coal seam gas
company. Refer him to ICAC.
They have?
They would, if you were saying
that. They would.
They would.
They would. They would refer him to ICAC straight away. He would be under investigation. But because it's wind and it's morally wonderful stuff, you don't need to pay any attention. He's gone to go do a good thing for his community.
Yeah.
Like, even though it's going to cause a massive erosion of property rights for these people, we're going to have to farm under this crap. The fact that it's going to be on your place forever, And it is the big thing is that it's turning agricultural land into industrialized land.
Yeah, yeah. Very, very true. Arable agricultural land that could be used far more profitably. You're exactly right. Vicky Campion, I've got to leave it there. I've run out of time. Thank you so much. I'm glad to see the sun is shining near Armidale. It's fantastic.
Thank God for our wood-fired heaters.
Hey, exactly. Wood-fired heaters. Brit, more, may they make more of them. Thank you so much for your time, Vicky. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
No problem. Vicky Campion, a columnist with the Daily Telegraph. Good to have her on. If you want to weigh into any of this, jump at our talkback lines right here on TNT.
Anticipate potential delays for the morning commute. In other news, a recent government report on prescription drug pricing points to corporate mouth.
Freedom of the press is about your right to know.
What are you talking about, man? Look at his stats.
It's about your right to be informed. Your right to access all types of information keeps us free as a nation.
No.
Today, there are real threats to press freedom.
Reaching residential areas by...
And your right to know about the world around us.
Look.
Some threats are obvious, some are easy to miss, but they all put our way of life at risk. We must defend against all of these threats, no matter what kind of news is important to you.
Justified putting American troops in harm's way?
That's a great question.
We must protect our right to know before it's too late. Understand the threats. ProtectPressFreedom.org.
Eggs. You can fry them, scramble them, poach them, boil them, or race them on a spoon. But uncooked eggs can be a risk for food poisoning. To be safe, avoid buying dirty or cracked eggs. Always wash your hands after handling eggs. And if you're concerned, pregnant, elderly, or have a poor immune system, make sure you cook eggs until the yolk starts to firm. Or look for new pasteurized eggs. For excellent eggs, handle them safely.
You're with Chris Smith on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Okay, I only got a little bit of time before we hand over to Sonia, but I do want to talk to two people about what has occurred with David McBride today. Firstly, one of our talkback callers, Robert, go right ahead. You were in court, were you?
Yeah, Chris, I'm Robert Barwick. I'm with the Citizen.
Yeah, I've seen some of your posts on X today. You must be absolutely outraged. Oh. I think I've just lost him on the talkback line. He was there. I want to go to someone else who's been very supportive. Cameron Leckie served 24 years in the Australian Army, retiring with the rank of Major. As a member of the Royal Australian Corps of Signals, he served in a number of regimental and training appointments, concluding his service as the Executive Officer of the 1st Signal Regiment. He is currently a PhD candidate at the University of Southern Queensland. Cameron Leckie, thank you very much for your time.
Can you hear me, Chris?
Nope. I can hear you now, Cameron. Yeah. What's your reaction to what you heard today?
Well, I'm not surprised, but extremely disappointed. I think this was an opportunity, to when you serve your nation and you have the moral courage to stand up for what you believe in and expose wrongdoing. And that's been punished, which I think is going to have a chilling effect on not just in the military, but in democracy as a whole.
And I think when you look at a crime, you try and work out what the advantage is to the criminal. I can't think of anything that he would have gained out of this professionally, promotionally, or, of course, financially. He had everything to lose, didn't he?
That's right. And, and that's where the moral courage comes in. He's taken this for the greater good. And every soldier who leaves the Australian Army gets a certificate of appreciation of their service. I have one sitting in my bedroom, and it talks about how we serve the nation. And we get told and reinforced throughout your training, throughout your career, about the importance of serving a nation, of doing the right thing, of moral courage. And then we have someone who actually does that, exposes, behaviour and actions by other Australian service personnel, which, is everything against what the Army was supposedly stood for. And that has just been shown. It's all a load of rubbish. When the person who exposes it, someone who goes to jail, and those people is the first person to go to jail and probably the only person who goes to jail.
Well, the only person, you're absolutely right. Having said that, let me play the devil's advocate for a second. I've spoken to a couple of servicemen and women who were not happy with what David McBride did because it put their own service and their actions in jeopardy. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think this comes back to some fairly fundamental questions about how and why we deploy troops overseas. And the only reason, really, that we deployed to Afghanistan was to support the alliance with the United States. And we did that, you know, not for the benefit of the Afghan people, not for any other benefit other than to, you know, maintain that alliance. And at the great cost, obviously the soldiers who killed, the ones who wounded, the ones who come back committed suicide, the ones who got ongoing mental health issues from their service, which if we were... We were acting in the interests of our country and only in our country rather than, you know, supporting a country whose record on human rights, whose record on illegal wars, proxy wars, regime change operations is absolutely disgusting. We wouldn't be in this situation in the first place.
Well said, well said. Retired Major Cameron Leckie, thank you very much for your time and thank you for being part of TNT's coverage of this.
Thanks, Chris.
Much appreciated. I want to go back to Robert, who I've got back online. He fell out there for a second, but I do want to get to him because he was in court when all of this unfolded today in the ACT Supreme Court. Robert, have I got your back?
Yes, Chris.
Okay, this is Robert Barwick. Just explain to my audience exactly who you are and who you represent.
Yeah, I'm the research director of the Citizens Party. So we have been helping to highlight David's case as a case of the government trying to stop people from finding out how government operates. And, you know, David drew back the curtain on that with his action. But the whole establishment turned against him, and you saw that with Four Corners' disgusting behaviour a month or so ago, just before this sentencing hearing.
Yeah.
They tried to make out, oh, no, he's not a whistleblower, etc. So they laid a narrative, and that gave cover to what the judge did today. The judge, the courtroom was packed, Chris. It was a very long ruling that he took more than 2 hours to read out. He admitted David was a decent man. He admitted that David did not profit personally from what he did. In fact, it's put his life through hell. He admitted David was sincerely motivated. He compared it to cases where the sentence was 2 years, and then he threw the book at this guy and gave him nearly 6 years. And it was so shocking. David's ex-partner, who's his biggest supporter, broke down crying. It was like a delayed reaction in the courtroom. Everyone just got increasingly angry as it sunk in what happened. And there was a lot of yelling. And the justice exited very rapidly. But it's a day of shame for Australia. He did the right thing. He told the truth. And this is how he's been treated.
I spoke with Jeff Morris a little earlier, and for my audience who were listening to Jeff Morris, I did want to come back with him after the news, but he fell out and I had to go on with an interview that I had planned. So my apologies for that. But my final question to Jeff Morris, you'll be able to answer. What was David's reaction?
Stoic. He sat there for 2 hours with his eyes closed most of the time, just absorbing what the judge was saying. He stood tall. He comforted his ex-partner, said goodbye to his dog, and left the building. So now he's in jail. This is his first night of incarceration that he's about to go through. His lawyer, Mark Davis, announced an immediate appeal, and they're appealing the judge's ruling that a soldier shouldn't follow his conscience, he should only follow orders. That's actually what they're going to appeal, which goes completely against the Nuremberg Code. But that's David for you. He's an upstanding man. It was clearly a big deal for him today. He was tense at first when he went into the court, and now I'm sure, knowing David, that you know he'll be feeling for his family. They'll be suffering more than he is.
See, it's interesting. One last question. It's interesting because if he knew what he knew and he didn't do anything about it, exactly. And you and I knew that he knew what he knew, we'd call it dereliction of duty, wouldn't we?
Well, you know, this new National Anti-Corruption Commission at a federal level, that is the definition of corruption under the Act. If you know, if you're an official in the federal government, you know and you don't do anything about it, you are corrupt. So by any measure, he did the right thing. This was a very legalistic ruling. The judge was detailed so he can cover his backside, if I can put it that way, against an appeal. And it's like The Merchant of Venice, Chris, where the judge rules in Shylock's favour. You can have your pound of flesh because natural justice doesn't come into it.
Yeah, well summed up, well concluded. Robert Barwick, thank you very much for calling in. Much appreciated.
Thanks, Chris.
All right, good to get your input. There you go. That's a good summary of it. If he was under the jurisdiction of a federal parliamentary public servant act, that is the new National Corruption in Act, if he'd ignored what he knew, it would have been corrupt. It would have been corrupt. How do you work that out? Just extraordinary. We will have further coverage throughout the afternoon and evening, Sydney, of course, and of David McBride's sentence. It's a disgrace. This is Chris Smith.